Welcome to our podcast. This is Rewind. Let's watch that again with Rochelle and Zach. We're going to be talking about movies between 1990 and 2010 that really helped mold us as we grew up in the 90s. Our first film is the Robin Williams classic Mrs. Doubtfire. I'm super excited to dive into this one. Rochelle, I cannot wait to talk about who is also a frontrunner to being the lead role of Mrs. Doubtfire. And if this person is selected, it would have possibly changed the roles of multiple movies that we grew up loving in the 90s and early 2000s. Stay tuned.
Mrs. Doubtfire, made in 1993, was directed by Chris Columbus. Other top movies you might know by Chris Columbus would be The Deep Blue Sea, Captain Phillips, Jaws, Titanic, 1492.
What are you talking about?
I'm just kidding. The real movies that he directed or produced would be The Help, Percy Jackson series, Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone, Harry Potter and the Chamber of Secrets, Home Alone 1 and 2, Bicentennial Man, which is also another Robin Williams film, among many others. This film is actually based on a novel by Anne Fine named Alias Madame Doubtfire.
So let's break down a quick synopsis of the movie. Daniel Hillard, played by Robin Williams, is a dad of three, and he's often out of work and he loses his job at the beginning of this film. He's throwing a party for his oldest son, or his only son, and his wife Miranda Hillard, played by Sally Fields, comes home and gets mad about this, and it's kind of like a last straw for her. She files for divorce. Since Daniel doesn't have a job or a place to live yet, Miranda is going to get sole custody of the children, and Daniel can only see the children every Saturday for a few hours. Down the line, Daniel finds out that his ex is going to need a nanny and volunteers to do it. She says no to him, and so Daniel devises a plan. He's going to dress as a woman, and he's going to play the role as a babysitter unknowingly to his family. He is now Mrs. Doubtfire, and is the new nanny for the family. Daniel is able to now spend more time with his family without the family knowing that it's actually him getting to spend more time with them. During this time, Daniel's actually learning to be more responsible as a parent, and he's able to tell the kids to clean and do their homework, which he would never have done pre-Doubtfire time. Record scratch, though, Miranda Hillard now has a new possible love interest. So not only does Daniel get to be around his kids more, it forces him to also now be around his ex-wife's new love interest in the life and with the kids' lives. While being Mrs. Doubtfire, Daniel is needing to get a real job in order to attain more time with his kids. He gets a job working in the back of a movie department, moving and shipping film reels. While he's there, he's able to be noticed by the owner of the business, and after some time, a funny meeting while Mrs. Doubtfire is out celebrating Miranda's birthday as Mrs. Doubtfire with the family, so happens to be the same time and place that he's having a meeting with the business owner. He gets the job to be the replacement for a long stand-in who does the children's learning show. At that time, though, during the party, Daniel is exposed of being Mrs. Doubtfire. So now the family knows that Daniel, or the father, or the ex-husband, is Mrs. Doubtfire. Summing up, in the end of the movie, they go back to court. Robin doesn't gain any more time with the kids. Robin does get the TV gig, though, and he plays the TV gig as Mrs. Doubtfire on screen. He's also really successful at it. You see in the movie that the family's actually seeing him on television, enjoying him on television. During the entire movie, Daniel's grown to be a better man and really a better dad now that he's done everything as Mrs. Doubtfire. In the meantime, though, Miranda's feeling bad about not getting any more time to Daniel, and Daniel's really improved as a father. So ultimately, she allows Daniel to be the new babysitter for the children to allow him to spend more time with them.
All right. So we all know that Robin Williams is infamous for his improvisation. He is an amazing improv actor. It is comical, though, that in the beginning of this film, Daniel, his character, gets in trouble for improvising his lines for the cartoons that he's doing the voices for.
Yeah, that's kind of crazy, too. And I'd like to speak, too, about that, because in the commentary on the film, Chris Columbus makes the comment that's not normally how these films are made. They're normally voice acted first, and then the animation's done over top of them. But he wanted to portray, you know, him having the job. And a cool part about it was that Chris Columbus did say that every single time that Robin Williams did that, he didn't even make a mistake. He did it like 5 times for 5 minutes straight, and his voice matched the animation's voice perfectly every single time.
That's amazing. And a fun fact, too, for the movie, for that cartoon part, it was actually drawn by Chuck Jones, which you guys, some of you may know who that is, some may not, but he is the cartoon artist for the Looney Tunes. And something to go along with Robin Williams' improvisation, too, thinking on this, he, again, amazing improv actor, but he would always at least do the script several times. But then he would have full reign to go improv. So he just gave them so much material to work from. He was just a truly an amazing actor and comedian.
Yeah, that whenever he did those improvs, though, tell them about like how it had to be kept track every single time he made a mention to something.
Oh, gosh, yeah. So that's where my heart went up for this woman that had to deal with this. So being known for the spontaneity, you know, as I mentioned, so much improvisation that he referenced so many movies that they had to get legal clearance to be able to use that. So the associate producer, Paula Dupree-Pesman, every single day she kept track and wrote down tirelessly all of the references that he made and got legal approval to be able to use those references just in case Chris decides to use that part in the movie.
Yeah, it's not just the ones we see, because, I mean, he done so many different references.
So many.
Not in the takes. And on top of that, there's that scene where it just strikes my mind, that scene where he dresses as Barbra Streisand whenever he's doing the whole makeup thing.
Right.
And they were able to get legal clearance for that one without having to pay royalties. Not royalties, but what is that called? The copyrights. They had the
copyrights, yeah. Yeah, because it's supposed to be Funny Girl is the movie that he was doing a parody of.
Yeah, and it's a parody. That's the reason why they didn't actually have to pay for that scene or spend the money for that scene. But speaking of, though, while you were talking about his improv, mm-hmm. since he did so many improvisations, that movie, it kind of resembled something like a documentary. So Chris Columbus had to like take clips and put them together and make sure, you know, it was leveled out right, because he could be really high doing something really high and loud and fast in one improv, and then the next one he could be really low talking about something else in some other person's voice. And so making sure it was seamless and seamlessly fit was kind of a headache for Chris Columbus as well. But, you know, he loved it. Like you said, he gave him free rein. He loved the fact that he was able to be an improv actor. And
he had so much to choose from.
He did. And speaking of many things
different
to choose,
ratings.
Yeah, speaking of things to choose from, there's different ratings of the film. There was the PG rating, the PG-13 rating, which is what it ended up being. Mm-hmm. There was an R rating and up to an NC-17 rating, which is like a TVMA but for film. And so just because you never know what's going to come out of Robin Williams' mouth.
Right.
It kind of makes me think of that Elmo scene where he's on Sesame Street.
Oh, and, yeah.
Elmo sees Robin Williams with the stick. He's like, what are you going to do with that stick? And I was like, oh my gosh.
Oh no. And there was one part where Robin was like, he did a joke. I can't remember what the joke was, but it was dirty. And he's like, I can't do this on a children's show.
Yeah. He started talking about lingerie. It was a lingerie.
Oh yeah.
Quip,
yeah.
On Sesame Street. He's like, yep. Because, you know, that's the thing with his mind. He could let it go anywhere. Like it would literally go anywhere.
Very creative mind.
Absolutely. For
Very
sure.
Very creative. And one of the ones that gave them a headache that he did use as a reference was where Miranda comes and picks up the kids, and he makes a reference of, oh, what is, I love this lovely Dances with Wolves motif. What is it called? Shops with Fist, which is a reference to Dances with Wolves. So that gave them that was a hard one for them to get, because they had to get legal clearance on that one for sure. My personal favorite improvisation, though, was when they are out to eat at Bridges celebrating Miranda's birthday, and Mrs. Doubtfire loses her teeth in her Chardonnay. And I didn't notice this until doing the research. He says,
I don't know how to go with it on this one. Literally, I say that all the time.
They is a proper thing.
This whole time I was doing research, I would say
Mrs. Doubtfire says, carpe dentum, seize the teeth. And they are trying to fish out the teeth out of her Chardonnay, which that's him making a nod to his earlier film, Dead Poets Society, where they say, carpe diem, seize the day. Which coincidentally, Robin Williams had earlier appeared in a very littly.
It's like Little Italy. It's like a little town, but
I don't know if my brain was trying to go with literally.
Let's just go with Littly.
Littly.
Yeah.
A littly known movie called Seize the Day, which was made in 1986, and I think it was an HBO made-for-TV movie.
Yeah, that the teeth, that teeth scene.
Carpe dentum.
I gotta put a little fixident on it. But that little adhesive, that whole scene. It was scripted that he was going to lose his teeth in the drink. That's all that was scripted. And then in the deleted scenes, but the commentary that we watched, Chris Columbus is like, he said every one of those reactions was, they had no idea what was going to happen.
It was genuine.
Yeah. They had no idea what was coming.
You never know with Robin Williams, honestly. It'd be hard to keep a straight face.
Pierce Brosnan, who was really good at keeping a straight face. We didn't realize it until we watched the commentary, but at the very end of that scene, if they didn't cut and pan to the right away from Pierce, he was just about to lose it at the
very
end.
Oh my gosh. For adults to have a hard time, but the kids, oh my gosh, the kids to not lose it.
There's no way. It would have been impossible. There's no way I could be in a comedy like with these funny actors.
Not at all.
I don't even want to go into The Office, but like if I were on a set of The Office, if I was Steve Carell, there's no way I would even be able to. I want to talk for a second about makeup in this film. So our makeup artist, that's the makeup specialist for this film. Her name is V. Neal, and she's done other notable movies and won Oscars for Ed Wood, Miss Doubtfire, and Beetlejuice. And she also had Oscar nominations for Edward Scissorhands, Batman Returns, and a couple of Pirates of the Caribbean films. I watched a video of her putting this mask, makeup, and all this stuff on Robin Williams. And I just couldn't believe how much actually goes into it.
Right?
Yeah. So the makeup took, at the beginning when she started doing it, it took about 4.5 hours. Towards the end, once they got used to it, it ended up being about 3 hours for it to be put on.
Still, that's such a long time. Oh my gosh.
Absolutely. Robin Williams would come in about 5 o'clock in the morning. He would have the makeup on by 9. That way he could film for 10 hours. And it would take about 1 hour for the makeup and mask and all that stuff to be taken off. We're talking, this dude was like, okay, let's do the math here. That's 10, 14, 15 hours. He's working 15-hour days.
And that's pre-cell phones there's Game Boys and stuff like that. But, I mean, still, pre-cell phones to where you can watch stuff and do anything on your phone, that'd be so boring.
So watching the film, he was just sitting there with his arms crossed, like staring into nothing. But after watching the commentary over the makeup, we did find out that there was a TV behind him that he was able to see and watch a film. So he's probably watching a movie whenever we saw it being taped, but we just couldn't tell that's what he was doing.
And I think they had a mirror too on the ceiling, so it was angled so he could also see whenever they had him tilted back and he could see the TV. I believe I heard them say that too. But
I didn't realize that.
Gosh, all that hair on him too. Can you imagine having to deal with that?
Oh, absolutely.
Lord, he was a hairy man.
And this film, too, it took 70 days for the film. They allotted 70 days for the film to be made. 40 of those days, he needed to have a mask on or makeup or whatever for the entire shoot. So that's a lot. And one of the cool little notes that I found online and also heard on the commentary is that the inspiration that they got was they found a picture from a woman in the 1940s. And they used that image as their inspiration for her, him.
There.
there.
There, the proper noun.
I'm going to go over there.
T-H-E-I-R.
That's there. Multiple, isn't it?
When you don't know which gender to go with, I think it's there.
I literally
But either
know.
Either way, that's really cool that they had an inspiration, they had a look to go off of, and that's what they chose. And I read, too, that the prosthetic mask that he wore in the movie actually, so as you mentioned, was the 8 pieces. But the scenes where he's taking the mask off, like in the bathroom or in his apartment, that was actually a prop. Which that mask there, that's what I've, my whole life of seeing this movie, I thought was how his makeup and mask was done. But no, it was like multiple, several layered pieces glued or adhesed.
No, I think that's right.
Pasted, whatever. Let's stuck to adhesed. Adhesed to his face. So I thought that was, you know, really neat there. So did you recognize the little girl that plays Natalie in this movie?
I did. That's Matilda.
That's right. That's Matilda. That's Mara Wilson. This was actually her debut film, which I had no idea this was. You know, later on we know her as, you mentioned, Matilda, but she's also in Miracle on 34th Street. Now, she's not acting so much in films, but she's doing voice acting a whole lot more.
Yeah, I'm actually kind of surprised by that. I really, really thought that she would be doing more. Like, whenever I think about her as a girl, she was in 3 of those huge movies. Mrs. Doubtfire, she's in that Miracle on 34th Street, and Matilda.
Right.
Those were huge.
Right.
And then she dropped off and went into voice acting and stuff. I was like, maybe we're just not watching her.
That happens, though, with child actors, because there's, I can't remember her first name, but she did the Pepsi commercials, curly black hair.
Oh, yeah. She's the sister to somebody.
She's a sister to somebody that I am sadly farting their name because they stay in Bloomington, too. That's so weird. Ah! Brain fart. This is awful. Anywho.
It's okay.
So a fun thing, though, a connection here. So Mara Wilson is in this movie, her debut film. The actor that plays Mr. Lundy, which is the owner, the person that's Robin Williams' main boss, like the head honcho. He is also in Miracle on 34th Street. Do you know who he plays in that movie with Mara Wilson in it?
I absolutely don't.
He's the judge.
On Miracle on 34th Street?
Mm-hmm.
I would have put him as Santa.
You would think, because of the white hair and beard and everything. Yeah, no, he's the judge that makes the final decision that Santa is Santa.
Well, good for him. I'm glad that's a decision that he made.
That's a very important decision for kids.
Yeah.
As you had mentioned with Mrs. Doubtfire being a big improvisational thing for Robin Williams, that many things were made off from it. It was also an inspiration for Tyler Perry for his character, Medea, which one of my favorite movies of his is Diary of a Mad Black Woman. Hilarious, hilarious movie. Anyway, Medea was his inspiration, as I mentioned, and even the catchphrase for her
that... Hello! I beat you to it.
You're a turd. Hello! Yes. That.
Hello.
Hello. Is based off of Mrs. Doubtfire's hello.
You didn't see that coming, did you?
Nope. I sure didn't. I thought that was really cool that was Tyler Perry's inspiration. Can I mention another part in the movie that I thought was really funny?
Yeah, please do.
Okay. So it was during the makeup scene, or not during the makeup scene, it was later on when Mrs. Doubtfire, Daniel, is revealed to his son, Chris, and to Lydia, his daughter, and Chris asked, who did this to you? And he just answers, Uncle Frank and Aunt Jack. I thought that was really funny and creative to go that route.
There's 2 scenes in this movie that makes me laugh every single time. And that's one of them. Just hearing him say Uncle Frank and Aunt Jack.
You get the giggles.
I know. And I thought it was just me. And thankfully, when we watched the commentary, Chris Columbus did mention that, you know, that
got the most laughs.
That got the most laughs. Yeah. Every single time they played it, it got the most laughs. And it was done in one take. I thought that was really cool.
Oh, yeah.
One of my favorite facts about this movie is that the original screenwriter, Randy Mayum Singer, she was actually, I couldn't find the exact wording. I heard the words fired, let go, released. Let's just go with released. She was released from the film because they wanted a happy ending, and she made an unhappy ending for the film, but they wanted it to be a happy ending. So they released her. She didn't want to do a happy ending. And so they did several rewrites with different happy endings, and they realized that, you know what, it has to go back to the original one because they didn't want to simulate or emulate to children that divorced parents are going to eventually get back together.
They don't want to give that false hope.
Yeah, so they rehired her. They rehired Singer, the original writer, and they went back to the original ending. Now, one of the cool things that just blows my mind about Miss Singer is that she was born in 1969. Mm-hmm. This film was released in 1993. Mm-hmm. That puts her around plus or minus 23 years old when she wrote the screenplay for the film. Mm-hmm. This is also her first screenplay.
Really?
This movie that made so many people laugh. It was just one of it won awards like crazy. This was her first screenplay.
Really?
Unfortunately, though, she didn't write too many more notable movies unless you'd count the notoriety of The Tooth Fairy with Dwayne The Rock Johnson or Alvin and the Chipmunks, The Road Chip. Now, not talking down on those movies whatsoever. Right. I love Tooth Fairy. I thought it was hilarious.
Oh, yeah.
But I just, you know, it's a big difference between her doing Mrs. Doubtfire and then those movies.
Right. And the story that she wrote in the whole screenplay of it all, they do such a good job of addressing for, because there's kids, you know, that they go through divorce with their parents and they feel it's their fault. And they have Mrs. Doubtfire address that, saying it is not your fault. You know, sometimes it's just better. Parents are better together. Parents are better for the child apart. They're better apart than they are together, and do not take blame on this. So I thought they did a really good job. She did a really good job on touching base on all of that stuff. Very, very moving, really.
Yeah. And listening to the commentary, whenever Chris Columbus is talking about, there's a scene where Sally Fields is talking to Mrs. Doubtfire and they're having kind of like a heart to heart in the kitchen. Chris says, you know, this scene's pivotal because it lets the dad, Daniel, know that maybe divorce is the best option here in this situation.
Right. And he's hearing too her side of why she wants a divorce. Cause I mean, it's one thing for him to ask, but he's finding out in the hidden mask of Mrs. Doubtfire, where she can open up and share that, whereas she wouldn't want to share that with him because she would be afraid to hurt him. But it's such moving, like as an adult now watching this and hearing the commentary and the meanings of this stuff, it really just makes it that much more of a special movie for me, for sure.
It's stuff that you don't realize until you look into it more.
Right. So the address that is given by Miranda while she's on the phone with Mrs. Doubtfire, that is actually the physical address for the Hillard's house that's in the movie that we all know. It is 2640 Steiner Street. And later on, when news of Robin Williams' passing was found out, that spot became a momentary vigil for him.
Yeah, it was. I mean, I saw the flowers and it was...
It's very touching.
It's touching, and they used an actual place. They used an actual place to be the shoot for the film, and it's still there today.
It's a gorgeous house.
Yeah. One of my scenes that I can't go without mentioning it is that, you know, the hello scene.
The infamous kitchen scene.
That's iconic. If you look up Mrs. Doubtfire online, that picture is going to come up. There's going to be a picture of her with white cream all over her face and the words, hello, over top of it.
Or dancing with the broom. Well, or cleaning. Oh, yeah. That whole part there.
Did I mention yet?
What?
About the dancing on the broom?
I don't think so.
So with that scene, it's really funny is that I can't remember the song that was playing in the movie.
Dude Looks Like a Lady?
Is it?
I'm pretty sure it is. Like a lady? Yeah.
I think
it's Aerosmith, right?
I think it is Dude Looks Like
I'm
a Lady.
I'm pretty sure, because there's like that whole guitar solo part, and he's playing the guitar on, like doing like the Chuck Berry thing and whatnot.
Yeah, but that whenever they are actually filming it, so Robin Williams said he wants to dance.
Okay.
And whenever they were actually filming it, they were not filming it with that song, but they're actually filming it with a Jimi Hendrix song.
Oh.
And so whenever he brings that broom up to his face, it's kind of like an homage about whenever Jimi Hendrix was playing the guitar with his teeth.
Homage?
Is that not a word? Homage? I thought that was the word.
Homage?
Yeah, that sounds...
It's just like literally, right?
That sounds a lot better when you say it.
Sorry about that.
But so that going back to that iconic scene with the stuff all over her face, that scene was almost fully improvised. They were going to use an avocado spread, like from ripe avocados that they found in the fridge, but it made him look like a 1960s horror monster.
Wizard of Oz witch.
Yes, it didn't get any laughs. It was like, oh, that's kind of actually frightening.
And not disturbing.
Not funny whatsoever. So they went with the icing from a cake. And as you know, if you remember the movie, as she's talking, it's like profusely dripping off of her face, and it drips into the tea. She's like, oh, you want one more?
Oh, how's another scoop?
Yeah. And so it's like splooshing.
Splooshing. Yeah, we're making up words here, and we're going with it.
This podcast is about making up words and seeing.
Eventually, it will be in a dictionary.
No, it already is.
Mm.
It's in my head. It just kept falling off, and it was totally improvised because it wasn't meant to fall off. It wasn't meant to be melting off, but the lights from that room during that scene, I think there were three lights on, and that they were making so much heat that they were melting it off of Robin Williams' face, and he improvised on things to say.
Of course.
Yeah. And of course. And you probably noticed, I noticed whenever I watched it, is like, from scene to scene, it doesn't match every single time. Like, I think in the second time we see it, there's more on the face.
Running down.
Well, I think the second time there's even more on his face than the first scene. So I think, you know, it's melting off. So like trying to apply it in between scenes.
Such a funny part.
But yeah, he improvised the majority of that entire scene.
Wow. One thing I found about Sally Field during the filming of this movie was, sadly and ironically enough, she was going through a divorce too. So those emotions that you see her go through were raw, real emotions, because she was going through a divorce herself along with her character.
That's sad.
Mm-hmm. Speaking on another character in the movie, the actress that plays Lisa Jacob, she was actually expelled from school because she took 5 months off to play the role. And when Robin Williams found out about this, he took it upon himself to write such a touching letter to her school, which Lisa Jacob said that she was just shocked that someone of that caliber of an actor so genuinely cared about her education and herself that he took the time to write a letter. And sadly, the school declined. Even though he wrote the letter, they said, nope, she's still expelled. But they framed his letter.
That's such baloney.
Right?
Can you imagine, like, you know what? That's really nice. Thank you. Thank you for sharing that.
We're going to frame it.
We're going to frame this. You're still expelled.
You suck. That's like the ultimate doctor's note right there from Robin Williams.
Not Robin Williams before Robin Williams was famous. Robin Williams, like, in the peak of Robin Williams.
Yeah, like when he was really starting to take off. Yeah, definitely. That's such poop.
I wouldn't do justice to this podcast about this film if I didn't talk about just a few differences between the book and the movie.
Okay.
In the book, Daniel and Miranda are actually separated before the story begins. However, in the film, we see that actually separation take place.
Hmm.
The reason why they did it is so we could, you know, have a little bit more feeling towards Daniel.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the thing with Daniel in the book, he's not portrayed as touching or caring. He does a lot more anger, has a lot more anger towards him in the book. In the book also, Daniel becomes angry at Miranda's early arrival at the dinner scene. So if you remember, you know, Daniel gets upset. We know that he's upset because he mentions and verbalizes to her, you dropped him off late. You're coming to pick him up early. And then that the Mara Wilson, what's her key line there? But don't say the bad words.
We're his GT kids too.
You could have just said it with the normal voice.
I had to impersonate right. it.
Yeah. Well, so, yeah, you see what I knew when we were over.
Hey.
No, I'm just joking. But yeah, so that's a funny, cute little line. We're his gosh darn kids too.
And she, and one thing they mentioned in the commentary for that part, if you look at Mara Wilson, she is struggling. Like the whole time they were filming that part, they had to take multiple takes because she could not stop laughing. So if you look at her, she's about to bust. And oh, it's the cutest thing because you can just see her, the full concentration, like, cannot laugh. I cannot laugh. So cute.
And last thing with the book, it's not like huge. These are not huge things because the book was good on its own. Surprisingly in the book, Lydia and Chris, the two oldest kids, they knew right away that Mrs. Doubtfire was their father.
Really?
Yep. So, they didn't, you know.
No, Chris walking in on him in the bathroom.
Yeah.
Gosh, that'd be disturbing.
Yeah. All right. So in the very beginning, I mentioned that there was someone who is also a front runner for, Mrs. Doubtfire. Everybody in the moon, under the moon, had the option of playing Mrs. Doubtfire. There's a lot of people who were a lot of choices, but there was someone who was a top front runner right along with Robin Williams. That person is none other than Tim Allen. And speaking of, so one of the reasons why that he turned it down was because, one, he didn't like the script as much, and two, I know, strange, but two, so he didn't like the script, and two, it also interfered with the taping of Home Improvement, so
really?
Which was, at that time, really
huge.
Successful.
Huge.
But what I mentioned earlier is it could have had a huge role. The next year, Tim Allen came out with so the Santa Claus. And so
love that movie.
We know the Santa Claus 1, 2, and 3. Santa Claus 1 was in 1994. Santa Claus 3 was, I think, in 2005 or 4.
I want to say I was in junior high when that movie came out.
No, it was...
Really?
It was 2005, I believe.
If it was 2004, I'd been in 8th grade. Okay, beginning of 2004.
Then let's say 2004, because I know it was early 2000s.
Yeah, I remember seeing it in theaters.
And so...
Both of them.
Those were huge movies for Tim Allen. And if he didn't play the Santa Claus in 1994.
And was Mrs. Doubtfire.
Someone else probably would have played the Santa Claus. But would they have been as good of the Santa Claus along with the Santa Claus 2?
Gosh.
Probably not.
I can't even imagine my childhood without the Santa Claus movies. I didn't care much for the third one. Really. The second one was good. But it just, the third one, not so much. But the first one, though, oh. Yeah. Love that one so much. One of my favorites.
To
watch it.
This is going to be one of our podcasts, I think. What about Christmas time? Somewhere around Christmas time?
Yep. Yeah. Definitely.
So
definitely. I did find on here that Chris Columbus was... Now every time I say Chris Columbus, I'm trying so hard to not say Christopher Columbus.
It's the same guy. No, it's not. I'm sorry.
He didn't sail the ocean blue in 1492.
I literally tried to make a joke and I had no idea where I was going with it. So I just
stopped. That was bad. Anyway, he was so impressed with San Francisco. And according to Robin Williams, after filming there, he decided that he wanted to move his family there to raise them. And Robin Williams lived there too, apparently.
Yeah. Robin Williams, he lived there and he said, hey, you got to come to San Francisco. The two choices for filming the site was going to be San Francisco or Chicago, and he decided on San Francisco after actually going there. So,
in the extras on the DVD, there are many deleted scenes, many of them, that actually you see a whole different side of Daniel, Robin Williams, Daniel's character, where he is really not the perfect dad person. He argues a lot, and you see exactly why Miranda probably felt this was the last straw when it came to that party, why they had to go through that divorce. Sadly enough, he had some growing up to do.
He absolutely did. And if we could have watched the entire film the way that it was filmed, you know, Chris Columbus said it would have been at least a 3-hour film.
Oh, yeah.
And nobody wants to sit through a 3-hour film.
We have, but not with this.
Yeah. So you have to like cut some things out. Mm-hmm. There was so much that they cut out of this that they filmed that would have explained a lot more of, you know, why there were more issues. There was the whole scene of whenever Miranda came home from the party. There was a whole scene outside of them talking and arguing the entire time while cleaning up the outside that we didn't get to see. It just cuts to inside the house whenever she talks about wanting a divorce. And we're kind of like, at that moment in the audience, I'm like, she's kind of a bad person. Why does she want a divorce right now?
That's ridiculous.
But if you would have put in those deleted scenes, you would have seen, oh, well, he's not really that great of a guy. But they didn't really want to portray Robin as being, or not Robin, but Mrs. Doubtfire slash Daniel as being a really bad guy. They wanted him to be a guy who has promise. He has the ability to maybe grow. So. Right.
And there's a scene too, which, it broke my heart watching it, honestly, because your heart goes out for the character of Lydia, where she's at a spelling bee and Daniel comes in to come watch it, and there's no seat saved for him by Miranda and Natalie and Chris. And so while Lydia is doing her spelling, Daniel is arguing with Miranda, but Miranda's keeping her cool, but they're making a scene, and it causes Lydia to mess up. And at one point, even like before she messes up, Chris is like, "You guys, you're messing up Lydia." And then they look and Lydia messes up, and you can tell she's about in tears because it hurts her to see the two people that she loves fighting. Like, oh my gosh, what a heart-wrenching scene. And man, I didn't know it existed until watching the deleted scenes.
Yeah, I'm glad we watched those anytime we get a chance to get our hands on a movie and watch deleted scenes and the commentary behind, like the director commentating, it's definitely worth it.
Right. I love knowing all these extra facts, things that you don't know. It might be considered useless information to other people, but I just love knowing this stuff.
Oh, yeah, for sure. And things that were deleted out of the movie that we didn't get to see is there was a whole storyline between Mrs. Doubtfire. I keep calling Daniel.
It's still Mrs. Doubtfire, though, because there's a part with her. Her and the neighbor.
So it's both. So I guess
it's
you're
both,
right.
Yeah.
There is a whole nother storyline between Daniel and the neighbor and Mrs. Doubtfire and the neighbor.
I can't remember her name. I keep wanting to say Miss Sellner, but that's the social worker.
Yeah, that's social worker.
But either way.
Yeah, but so there's a whole nother like story that we didn't get to be a part of. But there's one deleted scene that most of it came in and made the cut was the part where he rips the Mercedes-Benz ornament off the hood ornament off the front of the car. And it's kind of funny because it's a play, because in the deleted scene, there was more before it, and he's actually singing the song, a theme song for The Crying Game. And for those of you guys who have ever seen the movie The Crying Game, it's kind of a funny pun because that movie is about a hidden transgender woman.
Really?
So, yeah. Transgender person. Sorry.
I can't say I've ever seen this one.
I watched some of it, and I listened to the Boy George song.
How old is the movie? Is it an 80s one? I'm guessing, because this is 93.
Just by the feel of it, I would say late 80s. I'm going with 88, 87, but I can't.
Interesting.
I told you something earlier about a movie, and I thought it was in the 90s, and it was 1971, 79, something like that. Halloween movie that I was talking to you about.
That was in the 70s.
I'm not a super good judge of time, but yeah. So
the stunt double for Mrs. Doubtfire, which I didn't even know there was a stunt double for her or him, them. I'm having a hard time with that one. But either way, there's a stunt double for the fire scene where Mrs. Doubtfire is cooking a meal for the first time for the family. And She leans over the stove and her breasts catch on fire. I had no idea there was a stunt double there until watching the commentary. You learned that actually Robin had burned his hand in the original take on a metal spoon. And then the stunt double, they decided to go with more of the burning of the breasts. But if you slow it down a little bit, or now that I know to pay attention to it, you can tell that is not Robin Williams.
100% not him at all.
Oh, like, you can. It's totally like,
if you know to look for it, you're like, well, that's not him.
But otherwise, you're completely oblivious to it. Same thing with Pierce Brosnan's double. Did you know he had a double for this movie?
Not until it. But I should have. I literally should have known, because
it makes sense.
You're bringing up the diving scene. Go ahead.
Yeah. I am bringing up the diving scene. The way you can tell that is not Pierce Brosnan doing that dive is that his stunt double was not as hairy in the chest.
Yeah. Why would we think that Pierce Brosnan could do the half tuck triple?
Because he's knife? Pierce. He's James Bond. I mean, I would have figured he would have done that.
You're right. That's literally why we thought that. We thought that
it made complete sense.
Yeah. 100%.
You know, it's just like with Cameron Diaz. They thought that was her singing in the movie The Mask. And then when she's in the movie My Best Friend's Wedding and there's that karaoke scene,
yeah,
that's legit her singing. No one knew she could not sing.
Seriously?
Yeah.
Oh my gosh.
She was dubbed over in The Mask.
You're giving away, like,
I'm sorry.
You're giving away stuff.
But it's a connection here. I'm sorry.
People are going to be like, I remember, like, we're going to have some, like, stick around to hear this. I remember you even mentioning it in your first one.
Maybe they won't remember this one.
Maybe not. Fingers, oh my gosh, I hope they do. I hope they listen
and remember. But still, hopefully I'm not held accountable for it.
All right, I don't have anything else. Do you?
Nope.
Well, since you don't have anything else, this has been Rewind. Let's watch that again. Please look for us on Facebook and Twitter under the same name and follow us for updates on future episodes. Each new episode will drop every Wednesday, and we'll go into depth on another film we consider to be a classic from the 90s and 2000s.